So yesterday we discussed that the KMS condition, which is the notion of thermality that makes sense in quantum field theory, implied a series of conditions on the two-point correlator, the Wyman function. And this is the Wyman function defined as that. So in particular, conditions on the pullback of the Wyman function on a particular trajectory, okay, of proper time tau. The condition that it implies is that if rho is a KMS state of temperature 1 over beta with respect to partial tau, where partial tau is the tangent vector to the trajectory, so the four velocity of the trajectory t of tau x of tau, an arbitrary trajectory, then all that implies that the Wyman function is stationary. It implies a time translational invariant. It implies on the parameter tau. It implies holomorphicity in the strip, the zero imaginary of z beta. And it also implies complex antiperiodicity of the Wyman function. All right, so let's cast aside for a second, because those were definitions that were made out of the field directly, and let's get phenomenological on it. And the first step on that is, okay, so if I have a particle detector that is coupled to a stationary, let's do first stationary state of the field, of which, of course, thermal states or KMS states would be a particular case, as we discussed. How does a detector, if I couple to a state of the field and I let it evolve for a while, how does, or even if, equilibrates or not in contact with the field? And we will see what subtleties are there and so on. All right, so one of the things that we saw, I don't remember, 4 or 5 lectures ago, is that the response, the probability of excitation or spontaneous excitation or spontaneous de-excitation of a particle detector coupled to the field is got this expression. Plus minus, meaning the sign of omega, omega being the gap of the detector, and the gap of the detector, if you swap the sign of the gap of the detector, you swap in the ground and excited states, and therefore with a plus here, this is a probability of excitation, so you start in the ground state, and the probability of taking a transition to the excited state, and a minus is a probability of de-excitation, so you start in the excited state, probability of falling into the ground state. All right, so remember this F here that I defined, usually called the response function of the detector. Okay, let's see what happens if the field is in a stationary state. So if it is in stationary state, we get that P plus minus, well, let's just write. Well, in general, let's just write this expression, right? If we write F, let me define the following. Remember what this sigma, okay, a little bit, I want everyone to follow this. So you guys remember what this sigma is? There's an assumption here made on the switching function. And this switching function as defined is strongly supported around zero. Meaning like if tau over sigma is much larger than one or much smaller, as in not much smaller in magnitude, but much more negative, much larger in absolute value, then this thing is zero, it decays fast. So basically this thing has a bump around zero and then is almost zero everywhere. Okay, so the switching happens for a one time scale. So basically we can use the tangent word for this, right? This is the switching function. This is tau. So basically this tells me that function is kind of like this. So strongly supported around one, right? One minus one, by the way, tau over sigma, right? Otherwise it would be sigma minus sigma. Right, so the duration of the interaction is a timescale sigma. So there's a timescale sigma for which the interaction is on. And outside of that, the interaction is off. It could be a compactly supported function as a particular case, so strictly sigma only interacting, or it could be something smoother, like for example, a Gaussian or a Lorentzian or whatever you want. Okay, but the notion of strong support is understood. So we say, or I say anyways, that chi is strongly supported in a region of length sigma, if you want. Okay? Compact support is a particular case of strong support. Then again, this is a physicist definition, not a math definition. All right, so sigma being the duration, let's just write it here. Sigma is the duration of the interaction. All right, so let me define the Fourier transforms of the switching the following way, just for reference. We're going to use them. Let me define tau sigma. I can write as integral of minus infinity to infinity d omega psi tilde omega e to the I tau omega over sigma. This is just an implicit definition of the Fourier transform of chi. All right? And of course, I can define if I want, and I can call it tau prime just for convenience, this thing, d omega prime. And of course, I can conjugate the integrand. This thing is real. The switching function is a real function. So I can, if I want, conjugate the both sides of the equality, and the thing remains the same. So if I conjugate prime here, e to the minus I tau omega over sigma. Everyone happy with that? Basically, what I'm saying is that chi tilde is the Fourier transform of the switching. And of course, I can write it in this other way if I want, because the switching is a real function. Agreed, everyone? OK. Good. This is something that will be useful. So the first thing we're going to do is like, OK, let's write the response function of the detector, substituting the switching by its Fourier transforms, because that will be useful for what we want. So let me write f of omega sigma. It's going to be equal to 1 over sigma. And then I have, of course, integral minus infinity to infinity d tau, integral minus infinity infinity d tau prime. And then I get integral minus infinity to infinity d omega, integral minus infinity to infinity d omega prime. And then I get chi tilde omega chi tilde conjugate omega prime. And then I get the Wyman function tau prime. And then I get e to the I, and this is big omega plus omega over sigma tau minus big omega plus omega prime over sigma tau prime. So far, just a substitution. Nothing special here. OK, the first thing we're going to use now is, well, remember, we're talking about equilibration. So we are going to assume that the state of the field is stationary, is time translational invariant. It does not evolve with respect to the observer that is going on this trajectory. OK, with respect to proper time tau, the state is stationary. All right, so if that's the case, then we know the following. Where do I write this? I'll write here. I'll just be careful. If the state, or maybe rho, if you want rho field, right, is stationary, then we know that the Wyman function of t, so tau prime, is going to be just a function of delta, well, let me just write it, tau minus tau prime. Tau minus tau prime. Okay? Time translational invariance of the Wyman function, well, of the field in general, the field state, which implies that on the Wyman function. Okay, so if we do that, if this stays stationary, then we know we can do the following change of variables. The following change of variables, which is u is going to be the sum of tau and tau prime, and v is going to be the difference, tau minus tau prime. Okay? If we do that, well, of course, let me just write it. Tau is u plus v divided by 2. Tau prime is u minus v divided by 2. All right, so if we substitute that in into the response function of the detector, we get the following. F omega sigma is equal to 1 over 2 sigma, the 1 over 2 is the Jacobian of the transformation, integral minus infinity to infinity du, integral minus infinity infinity dv, integral minus infinity infinity d omega, integral minus infinity to infinity d omega prime, and then we get the switchings, Fourier transform of the switching, omega, Fourier transform conjugate of the switching, omega prime. Now, W, is a V in here. I did the opposite. Okay, well, I did. I'll try to adapt. W, just watch for it, because I tend to make these stupid mistakes. Of V, and then E to the I over 2. They do it right. Tau is plus, yeah, definitely. And U minus is tau prime. You see, I did it right. Okay, fine. 1 over 2, omega plus omega over sigma V, and then E to the I, to the, I over 2 sigma omega minus omega prime. This is a U, my bad. No, this is a B, sorry. And this is a U. All right. Cool. All right, this is just substitution. Okay, so the nice thing in here is that we realize that the integral over U is what? The integral over U we can do, right? What is it? What you tell me? If I integrate over U, what do I get? Oh, come on, you know this one. Tell me, don't be shy.
Delta.
It's a delta. All right, so in particular, we know that the integral minus infinity, infinity, dv, or du, sorry, of e to the I over 2 sigma omega minus omega prime u, it's equal to, well, let's two steps if you want, 2 pi delta of 1 over 2 sigma omega minus omega prime, which is the same as 4 pi sigma delta omega minus omega. Agreed, everyone? So that integral we can do right away. And if we do that integral and we get a delta, means that I can do the integral over omega prime, for example, as well, using that delta. Okay? So what I get is the following. F of omega sigma, it's equal to, now we get the 2 pi in the numerator, integral minus infinity to infinity, du, d omega, all right? And then I get, doing the integral with respect to omega prime, I get that omega is equal to omega prime because of the delta, so this becomes the modulus square of the Fourier transform of the switching function, and I get modulus square of chi tilde omega, right? And then I get W of, oh, I call it U. You see, those are the things I'm talking about. V E to the I divided by 2, omega plus small omega over sigma V. Well, this is nice, because now the integral with respect to V is a Fourier transform. Agreed? And I kind of laughed this morning because I saw that, which is kind of related, but anyway. The thing that got stuck in the board is related with this object that we're doing right now. Anyway, integral with respect to V is a Fourier transform of the Wyman function. Agreed, everyone? Right? So the result of this integral, if I write it, is 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity d omega, switching square tilde omega plus omega over sigma. So this is really nice for several reasons. Now, if you see the response of the detector will be, for a stationary state, would be an integral over the power spectrum, which is what is written in there, right? Of the field, if you want, so the Wyman function Fourier transformed. But in this power spectrum, the power spectrum of the detector, if you want, also influences it. How long the detector is on and how fast the detector is switched has an influence on how many of the UV frequencies we're going to see. You see, if the switching is very short, then the Fourier transform will extend and we will see the ultraviolet. If the switching is very long, we will not see the ultraviolet because the Fourier transform is shrinked, right? Or shrunk, I guess. Isn't that cool, though? This is real. This is how, for real, a detector, something that you stick into the field, sees the field. The things that you actually use to measure the field in whatever experiment you think of, think from high energy to human vision with your retinas, this is the way in which we see the power spectrum of the field for real, okay? Convoluted, if you want, in a way, with the switching of the detector. All right. So now, with this, we kind of finish with the math, and we need to do physics. Because you need, with math, I'm not gonna be able to find the result that, you see, thermality is oftentimes related to something called detail balance. Have you heard those words before, detail balance? So what does that mean? What does detail balance mean? What does that mean? Who can tell me? For a detector, tells me something along the lines of, and then I will, this is approximated for now until we make it rigorous. Approximately mean like rough, kind of the probability of excitation divided by the probability of the excitation has to go like the exponential of beta omega, right? Which detail balance is just a condition that tells me, right, the probability of a process and its reverse is the same. That's what happens in equilibration. You equilibrate because something is happening, then it's not an equilibrium situation because something happens, but suddenly you're kind of giving stuff to someone else, but that someone else starts returning the stuff back, and at some point you reach a fixed point, right? When the probability of sending something here is the same as receiving it, and then you are in equilibrium. That's what's behind detail balance. And by that, it's telling you, well, if the process of going that way, of the excitation, has the same probability of excitation, that means that the only reason why they are in balance is because there are way more excited states, way more atoms that are excited than atoms that are de-excited. So basically, it's a Boltzmann factor, the difference between the two. It's just the population between the two levels that makes the difference. Agreed? That's kind of what's behind detail balance. It's a very reasonable physics-wise way of talking of equilibrium, and in particular, thermal equilibrium, when you have a Maxwellian distribution kind of thing. Agreed, everyone? Right. So I would expect, right, that I should get something like this in the case of thermality, or in general equilibration. But here's the thing. Let me just do one thing. So a physicist, let's do two levels of physics, if you want. Very hand-wavy and then a little bit more careful kind of physics. Very hand-wavy. What are you tempted to say? So imagine, because right, how to put it? We're talking equilibration, and equilibration is not going to happen in short times, right? For something to equilibrate, you need to wait for long times. Agreed? And if you're talking about the detector has a time scale, which is the gap of the detector, the energy difference between them. That's a frequency. That's an inverse time. and you should expect that to equilibrate, oh, definitely you have to wait for longer than the natural frequency of the detector. Agreed? Right? That's kind of what people call in experimental physics, if you want, the Heisenberg limit, in a sense of like, oh, below that gap, you don't even know because the oscillations, is when the oscillations between ground and excited in a superposition keep happening and things like that. So you need to wait more than that time. And then you say, okay, let's talk now. If sigma is large, so what does that mean? If sigma, if you want, let me just write it. For long coupling times, then we know that sigma is large. So in particular, sigma over omega is much larger than 1. Oftentimes you say, oh, sigma goes to infinity, because that's what we're going to do in the end. Right? Or sigma over omega goes to infinity. Oh, no. Tell me those things. Of course, sigma times omega goes to infinity. Agreed, everyone? That's what it means to be long when you have a detector. There's only one time scale, which is omega minus 1, right? All right. So what are we tempted to do? For those times, we are tempted to say temptation. This is the hand-wavy way, huh? Temptation. Oh, f of omega, comma, sigma going to infinity, let me just write it like that, should be like, what are we tempted to do if sigma goes to infinity in this expression? What is the first instinct that one has? What would you do? I know you're careful, but imagine that you're not that much careful. And you just want to simplify things. And you're hard-pressed to simplify things. Because you're about to write a paper. And that paper will give you what you want. If only I could do the approximation that makes sense to do, right? What would you be tempted to do in that case? Come on. Say it. I'm giving you license. Say it. What would you want to do? I definitely would, yes.
Cross up a little
omega. Right? You would like to do this. 2 pi minus infinity to infinity d omega chi omega squared, and then having something like this, right? And even more so, you'll be tempted to say, I don't care yet, but this thing is this thing now doesn't depend on omega, right? And that would be very nice because that would be 2 pi Wyman omega, and then the integral, oh, this is nice. This is the L2 norm of the Fourier transform of the switching. Now, if the switching, we take it normalized to 1, then the norm, as I define the Fourier transform, would be 1 over 2 pi, which is really nice because this is, if you want the L2 norm of this thing, right? And this thing is 1 over 2 pi, as I defined it. Right, because my Fourier transforms are not unitary. And my Fourier transforms don't have the factor that makes them unitary. So it's 1 over 2 pi. This is very easy. Just substitute in these things. I calculate the norm and substitute in these expressions. But the inverse, right, with a minus in there. It's 1 over 2 pi what you get out of the norm. Not going to do that. Very easy. So that would be super nice because, oh, by the way, I'm missing the tilde. Because that would be an amazing result that the response function of the detector for infinite times to a stationary state would be the Fourier transform of the Wyman function evaluated at the gap of the detector. That's super intuitive, and it's like, oh, that's how we measure power spectra in real life, right? We have a detector, and basically the detector, we let it equilibrate with whatever signal we're measuring, and the equilibration will just be the power spectrum evaluated at omega. That's a simplification that everyone does when they talk about how to interpret experiments, I don't know, in cosmology, things like that. Wouldn't it be nice to just throw out this in that limit? Okay, can we do it, though? How many of you would feel bad about doing that? Wait, tell me why. Why don't you tell me why?
In the bounds of the integral, like we have minus infinity plus infinity, so.
Precisely. So the problem that we have here is that we're integrating on the whole domain. And we're kind of saying, if we do that, that sigma is much larger than any omega in that integral, which is infinity. So what the heck are we doing here? Now, if you notice, we have this thing here as well. And here's the argument. It's like, well, and this is, again, now being a physicist still, but a much more careful physicist. It would be, but this thing is not anything. Think of the switching function like that thing that I have on the tangent board there. Right, so if this is like this, then I know roughly, again, we're still doing physics, right, that this thing would be kind of like this as well. And this thing is going to be around 1 over sigma. No? It's the Fourier transform. Agreed? We have an uncertainty principle between them. Right? If they're Gaussians, if they saturate that kind of uncertainty principle, it would be like that. So it's saying, OK, so this thing is also strongly supported in a scale 1 over sigma. So for omegas that are much larger than 1 over sigma, this thing is going to suppress the integral. So the UV is suppressed on scales that are small omega. So this thing, so suppressed for omega much larger than 1 over sigma. Agreed, people? So you would say, right, so I can kind of do this integral and do this approximation as long as this suppresses the UV. So the switching has a finite duration. And that duration, and I'm talking of a limit of sigma going to infinity, so definitely kind of a small limit. Physics, hand-wavy, right? But kind of makes sense, right? And then you would say, right, using the fact that this thing is only supported on regions where the approximation makes sense, then I can do the approximation, right? And in the limit, I hope it's an exact approximation. Better, no? Not great yet. Who has problems with that still? Oh, that's where the physics ends, if you want. Now we need to do a little bit of math if we want to actually make a statement. It's still physics, but at least kind of supported by rigorous math. And there's a consequence of that rigorous math. The problem with this is that for this thing to be true, you still need that whatever the tails. So I'm talking about scales only. That's where the physics ends, right? When you talk about scales, but there's a problem with it. Like the tails of a Fourier transform are not guaranteed to be falling fast enough in general. In particular, you have here a distribution, right, on the frequency spectrum. And that distribution, I don't know. You don't know how the tails go when omega goes to infinity. What if this thing kind of goes wild there? Then this thing has to tame it. And for this thing to tame it, you need that the Fourier transform has tails that are powerful enough to tame anything that could happen here. Agreed, people? In particular, if you do compactly supported switching, then you know that the tails of this thing are going to be polynomial at best, right? And polynomial tails have no guarantee of taming the Wyman function. The Wyman function, actually, you can compute that for most states, again, you can have really, really ill states, right? But for stationary states, tends to go like polynomially to zero. I mean, you can do all these way more rigorous. You can talk about the Hadamard, the Pauli-Jordan, the commutator is a singular part, and that singular part is at worst a principal value of 1 over the frequency, so that's kind of, and the best is a delta, and that's dimension dependent and so on. And then you can talk about the Hadamard, and you can tell that the Hadamard, when it's stationary, has to decay kind of polynomially. It could be very high polynomial, but polynomially anyways. So if you go rigorous about it, you say, this limit makes sense as long as the switching, you cannot pick your switching arbitrarily. You cannot do a step function. Which is basically, by the way, what we tend to do when we write the u of from t0 to t, then is equal to the time order exp of t0 to t, minus I, t0 to t, dt, h of t, right? When we write that, we are implicitly saying the integral starts and ends at sharp edges. So we are using a switching function that is like this, step function, or a top hat function. If we use a function like this, you will not equilibrate. You cannot take that limit, because then you get that the Fourier transform has polynomial tails, the Fourier transform of the switching. Polynomial tails are not guaranteed to tame this fast enough to do this approximation. So for this result to be true, you require also something that wouldn't work either. So see here, no matter how big I make this, if I get sigma to infinity here, I still get polynomial tails in the Fourier transform. And the limit, you cannot swap limits and integral in the way that we're doing here, which is basically what we are asking. Is there uniform convergence to a limit when I take the limit outside and take it inside of the integral and do it? That's what I'm asking. Can I do that? You cannot for most cases. You need behavior at infinity of this thing to be nice enough in order to do it. Nice enough is kind of the best way to say it, because for some cases you can prove that yes, more than polynomial is enough for the Fourier transform. Sometimes it's, when you want to be conservative about this, you say for switchings that are nice enough, that decay, the Fourier transform decays fast enough. And that translates into physics by saying, no, this doesn't work. You know what wouldn't work even if you take this to infinity? But people would say, OK, fine, this compactly supported function is discontinuous, right? How about a continuous version, a class infinity version of this, like very smooth function? Same thing, you still have polynomial tails. You cannot escape that. There's a property of the Fourier transform, right? The Fourier transform of a compactly supported function would have polynomial tails. You cannot do things with two scales, as in like, oh, how about I start like this and then continue for infinity and then continue like that? You have two scales, you see? You have a delta scale and a sigma scale, a switching scale and a very long scale that you take to infinity, but you switch on like that. That doesn't work either. Again, you get polynomial tails again. So you need to have only one scale in your switching, and you need that scale to be smooth. For example, a Gaussian would work. A Gaussian, the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is another Gaussian, that's exponentially suppressed, better than exponential, so nice. A Lorentzian works. The Fourier transform of a Lorentzian is an exponential, that is, that tames any polynomial tails, no matter what. So any switching function whose Fourier transform is exponentially suppressed in the UV will work, will allow you to take that limit. And that's why I write the adiabatic limit, sigma to infinity, adiabatic limit, that's how I call it, which is take a duration of the interaction very long, but assume the interaction is switched on infinitely slow. That's what we're doing when we do a scale and we take the limit. The interaction is when we take the limit of infinite time or very long times on a Gaussian, what we're saying is also the process of getting to the maximum is made very slowly, okay? So in the adiabatic switching limit of F omega sigma going to infinity, then we know this thing is the Fourier transform of the Weinmann function. All right, so statement here, a detector coupled to a stationary state of the field, if allowed to equilibrate adiabatically, which means let the detector interact really slowly for a long time, so let the interaction build up slowly in time, and take that time to infinity. So you see, in the end, physics-wise, it's difficult to do. One has to be careful to talk in physics about this, because mathematically, it's just an interaction that is on forever. And that kind of physics, interaction that goes on forever, can come from step function, right? That you take sigma to infinity, still on forever. But then the thing only equilibrates, right, when the interaction is taken a particular way of taking that limit. You see, you take an interaction that is finite time with one scale, then take the limit of infinity of that thing carefully. This is behind, by the way, if you think of your particle physics, this is behind why people compute transition rates and not transition probabilities, because it's so bad that if you have actually a step function here and you're in three dimensions, the step function Fourier transform, well, top hat kind of switching, right? Fourier transform gives you a sink. The sink cannot tame the way in which this goes at infinity, and you get divergences. In three dimensions, you get logarithmic divergences in the response of the detector. So the transition, when you do Fermi's golden rule, you're not computing probabilities, you're computing transition rates, and you take kind of a limit of sigma going to infinity of a step function kind of thing. And this thing would be even divergent. The detector in three dimensions would not, in one dimension is fine, in two dimensions is fine. In three dimensions, it would blow up logarithmically at infinity. You get UV divergences in the response of the detector. A switching that is discontinuous is very unphysical and is not innocent. How you switch the interaction is not innocent. Keep in mind, you're making the Hamiltonian time dependent, right? It's nothing here, and suddenly here, the amount of energy you put into the system is horrible. It's infinite, rigorously speaking. You have the derivative of the Hamiltonian is something that peaks, right? It's a delta kind of divergence. So careful with sudden switchings all the time. And careful when, oh, I'm not switching, I'm on forever. No. To make sense of that, you need to think of it as a finite time interaction, take the limit, and depending what kind of interaction, you will get one thing or another. So super careful with that. Again, you can solve it by computing transition rates, because the kind of way in which it goes to infinity, the divergences you put in here are independent of anything, the state of the field, the space-time background. So yeah, of course, if you have two infinities and you kind of remove them by subtracting to things that are equally infinity or dividing or things like that, then you get something that makes sense. That's why Fermi's golden rule makes sense when you do it properly. If you are explaining Fermi's golden rule in a quantum mechanics course, as I've done, it feels a little bit like, well, you get an infinity, okay, that goes with T, so let's divide by T and things like that and work. But no, there's stuff behind it. There's ways of understanding how this goes rigorously. All right. So, claim, a detector adiabatically switched on for infinite time equilibrates to the state of the field, and the response of a detector is proportional to the Fourier transform of the, what they call in that board, power spectrum of the field, what I would call the Wideman function Fourier transform, evaluated at the gap of the detector. So it's the power spectrum of the field evaluated at the gap of the detector. I don't know what course was this, but it's very convenient that it was stuck with that.
Cosmology.
What's that?
Cosmology.
Nice. All right, questions? All right, let's go to thermality now, because this is for any stationary state. All right. So, observations about thermal states in particular. All right, that works. Okay, so for if the state is KMS, we also know the following. We know that, and this is super important, we know that the Wyman function, delta tau, plus, did I have plus? I should have, anyway, yeah, plus, it doesn't matter. Plus I beta, it's equal to W of minus delta tau. And then we can go about it, well, we want something on the Fourier transform, right? So we can take Fourier transform on both sides, and we can go physicist about it again. So if we take the Fourier transform on both sides, on the right-hand side, sure, we get W tilde of minus omega, right? And on the left-hand side, I get and then you say, oh, that's easy, because I remember the properties of the Fourier transform. And you say, oh, it's a translation, right? So that would be an exponential of I, the amount translated, right? These are the properties of the Fourier transform, no? So this thing should be, with that property, should be e to the minus beta, right, minus beta omega. Right? That's applying the property of the Fourier transform, right? No? Yes, no? Perhaps? Okay. Well, that would be convenient. If that is true, that would be convenient because look at what happens with the response of the detector if it's KMS. If the response of the detector, the response plus minus, the ratio, let me call it like the adiabatic limit, sigma going to infinity, of the ratio of excitation to the excitation, it's equal. Remember, when the factors in front of the response function are constant, so they cancel in the ratio. So this is f of, is the adiabatic limit, sigma going to infinity, of f of omega sigma divided by f of minus omega sigma. And that is just the ratio of the Wideman Fourier transform, right? So that's nice. So it's W omega divided by W of minus omega. And that's very nice because I can relate the two. In fact, the ratio of the two, I can compute directly isolating for the ratio in here. And this thing is nicely enough e to the beta omega. Oh, nice. This is detailed balance, isn't it? How cool this is. Look what that would mean. If I stick a thermometer, which is a detector, a two-level system in this case, that detector, I let it equilibrate with a thermal state. If I let it with a KMS state, then that detector evolves to a Gibbs state. You see the ratio of populations of the detector is given by the Gibbs thermal state distribution, which is a Maxwell distribution, right? So what it means is that, and nicely, the temperature of the detector that acquires after thermalization is the KMS temperature of the field. How nice would that be if the detector, if a thermometer, which is the detector here, that has a definition of Gibbs thermality that is well-defined, partition functions are fine, finite dimensions, you stick it to the field in a KMS state of temperature beta, the detector, as long as the detector is switched on adiabatically, the detector thermalizes, and thermalizes to the temperature 1 over beta, Gibbs temperature, and that Gibbs temperature is exactly the KMS temperature of the field. Oh my God, the KMS temperature outside of the realm of Gibbs temperature, it's actually something that satisfies the zero law of thermodynamics, equilibrates with a Gibbs thermal system at the same temperature. Nice. Good generalization. Well done. Wouldn't that be convenient? Have I cheated, though, to get here? Can anyone see if I cheated? I mean, if I asked, probably I have, no? This step. Remember how we got the property of the Fourier transform? Let's do it. So the Fourier transform, this is an aside. Let's go back to second year, whatever course you saw Fourier transform for the first time. The Fourier, I used F already. The Fourier transform of a function, f of x minus x0, or maybe I'll call it, it's fine. It's equal to, depending on how you define it, let's define it like I did here, the integral of minus infinity to infinity of the omega, and then you get the function f x minus x0, and then you get e to the I omega x. And then you say, I do a change of variables, right, here, and I call x prime equals x minus x0, right? And then this thing becomes, under that change of variables, becomes the integration limits. I mean, your calculus prof would have told you, the integration limit's obviously the same, right? Because one goes to infinity when the other goes to infinity. X0 is finite, so fine. And then I get the omega, it's not, sorry, I'm not even integrating here. The omega, I'm doing a wrong thing and you don't tell me. Sorry, my bad. The x prime now, and then you have f of x prime, and then you get here e to the I omega x prime, but also you get e to the I omega x zero. And now you say, this e to the I omega x zero, I take it out, and this is just the Fourier transform of the function multiplied by that phase. Agreed? That's the translation property of the Fourier transform. Can we do that in this case, though? Yeah.
Yeah, Yeah, if you want x naught to be imaginary, then you have to be much more careful.
Way more careful. Amazingly more careful, because if you repeat the same thing here, and now this thing is an I like that, and this thing is an I like that, your integration contours are no longer the real line. You are pushing it up in the complex plane. See what I mean? What you get when you do the change of variables here, to prove that property, what you're doing here is, let me just, I don't have a, oh, I have another board, which is nice. No, I don't, I forgot that this thing doesn't work. Okay, I'll do it here, because I think the cameras won't see that board. If you want to do the translation property, you can, but what you end up with is not another Fourier transform. It's something like this, plus I x0 plus I x0 kind of thing. You are integrating, so you start integrating here on this line in the complex. Oh my god. Sorry about sucking a drawing. Try to do it better. You're integrating here for the Fourier transform. And now, to do this translation property, you can write this exponential outside, but this thing is no longer a Fourier transform, right? What this thing is now is an integral on this contour. Because you displaced it a little bit, I beta. Right. Nicely enough, if the state is KMS, we know that the Wyman function is holomorphic in that particular strip, which is really nice because it means that there's no poles inside here. Nice, so I can write the integral that I get, I is gonna be equal to, well, the integral on the whole contour, right, is zero. So the integral on the whole contour close at infinity is zero. So there's no poles inside, the integral is zero. And this integral is exactly equal to this one, which is nice, they cancel each other. So what you get is that the integral over the imaginary displaced part that you have is equal now to the integral on the real part, that is the Fourier transform. So you can equate it, whatever this function was at the beginning, you can equate it to the Fourier transform because the Wyman function is holomorphic in the strip 0 to beta. Without holomorphicity, there is no detail balance. Look how important the holomorphicity condition is. Agreed? If you have poles inside that strip, the thing does not thermalize in the way we know. It won't, the detector, the thermometer, right, will not get a reading out of a temperature. It will not get a thermal population. It will not give thermality. It will not satisfy detailed balance. All right? So this condition, and I stress it quite a bit, because this condition, the holomorphicity condition, is oftentimes ignored. When people talk about KMS, you oftentimes will see in papers in high energy physics, in cosmology, in fields in curved spaces, it's common to talk about the KMS condition this way. As this, of course, stationarity, right? I mean, thermal state has to be stationary, and also complex antiperiodic. But they don't talk much about this property. This property is as fundamental as the others. Which is super nice, though. Huh? Like, it's amazing because when these conditions were given, keep in mind that people were not thinking of how thermometers would thermalize with other things. This is a different thing. Now we have an interaction question.
Yeah, why does the integral and the borders and the strip cancel each other out?
You need to prove that, but they do, yes. It's a limit. You can do it in the limit sense. So basically, you're going in one direction in one and one in another, and they're identical. There's a symmetry in the integrand. We can do it offline. But yes, they do cancel. What was I saying? I forgot. No, okay. So when people were establishing the KMS condition, they didn't think of, I'm going to stick thermometers to things and I want them to thermalize and have detailed balance. People were talking about, okay, what is fundamental about thermality or gives thermality on objects that are more fundamental, the two-point correlators that I can define in context where even states are divergent and don't make sense and the state that should represent this is not trace class and what the heck. And yet, this is a consequence of it. A detector and the holomorphicity condition didn't come from the need of satisfying detailed balance, but see how important it is in order for a thermometer coupled to the field to satisfy detailed balance. All right. So let's recap. If you have a quantum field in a thermal state, and thermal state understood as KMS state, of temperature beta with respect to time tau, and then you stick a thermometer that has proper time tau, that thermometer, as long as the thermometer interaction with the field is adiabatic, so careful with the switching, then the thermometer thermalizes, acquires a Gibbs temperature in that limit that is equal to the KMS temperature. Agreed? All right. Now, with these ingredients, we can now talk about the Andrew effect for real. How was the tutorial? Was it okay? I couldn't make it. I have committee meetings at the times of the tutorials today, as yesterday and tomorrow. Did it go okay? You're in the middle of it, I guess? Huh? Or maybe you finished, I don't know. So you did the classic derivation of the Andrew, or the first kind of derivation of the Andrew effect. We're gonna do the more modern derivation of the Andrew effect, which is now out of the discussion. Oh, but then you need acceleration forever. No, hold on. If I stick a thermometer that is accelerating, will it and is interacting with the vacuum state of the field, will that thermometer thermalize? And if so, to what temperature? So because of these results that we have, what we need to prove now is that the vacuum state of the field will be KMS with respect to observers that go with proper time, partial tau, that are constantly accelerating. So the partial tau would be the generator of boosts, constant acceleration. And now you see, you don't need infinite times. You just need adiabatic regimes, meaning like the detector is interacting for a long time, much longer than the inverse gap of the detector, in an adiabatic kind of way. And will that detector acquire detailed balance? Will the population be thermal? Will the detector thermalize? You know, if that's true, that's a phenomenological definition of the Andrew effect. It's what an experimentalist would see. If you get a thermometer, you stick it to the vacuum. In an inertial thermometer, then the thermometer will thermalize to zero temperature. But if you accelerate the thermometer and you do nothing else, the thermometer will thermalize, perhaps, to a different temperature. That is the Andrew effect. Any questions? So, oh, by the way, next time that you see integrals from T0 to T, at least remember that problematic. How you switch is important. Yes?
I'm curious because it seems like there's somewhere, we somehow hit somewhere the assumption that this detector has zero specific heat. Where is that?
It doesn't have zero specific heat. This detector has a gap omega. So the specific heat that it takes to take it from the ground state to a particular Gibbs state is not zero. So the heat capacity, let's talk about heat capacity because it's one detector. So the heat capacity of the detector is positive. It would cost you energy to excite it. But keep in mind that we're waiting. So here's the thing. The heat capacity is zero as compared to how long the interaction is. So you're allowing the detector, what you're saying is that hold on, I misunderstood. What you mean is, back reaction, right? As in like the detector is not cooling down the field. Yes, good one. Yes, let's remember, very good one. This is the kind of question I like. This expression up there was computed in leading order perturbation theory. Back reaction effects are higher order. And you would be completely legitimate to say, how can you guarantee? Sir, if there's no back reaction, and that's the zero specific heat that you're saying, and you saw right, the detector does have specific heat, but the field is not back reacting on the detector. The detector is not back reacting on the field because we're at leading order in perturbation theory. You would be legitimated to say, hold on, how do you know this is true also when you sum the perturbative series or when you do the thing non-perturbatively? Great question. You can do it still. It's complicated. And I'm not going to tell you, it works as well. No, there are complications and there are subtleties. But the whole thing is, let me give you a hand-wavy argument at least. What the detector does to the field propagates away. So if the detector is not going at the speed of light, if the field is massless, and the detector doesn't go at the speed of light, you can obtain a non-perturbative result as well. Basically, what the back reaction on the field propagates away, and the field kind of locally looks thermal. So the detector keeps thermalizing, because the field along the trajectory keeps looking thermal, because again, the perturbations go away. Not true if the field is massive. for example. And it's a dimension-dependent statement, what I told you too, as in like, you get if it's a free theory, it's still fine. If it's not a free theory, then the commutator in the time-like area becomes state-dependent. And when the commutator becomes the expectation of the commutator, right, for a free theory, it's very easy. It's a C number. It's not state-dependent. It's proportional to identity, the commutator. So the expectation is independent of the state. If you have an interactive theory, that's not true anymore. The commutator is state-dependent. So in the time-like area, you get commutator contribution state-dependent that the back reaction of the detector can be. The detector can be faster than the speed of propagation of the signals for a massless field. And therefore, it cannot leave behind all that back reaction. So there are subtleties with that. So good question. This is a perturbative result. So assuming another assumption, right, which is, by the way, in thermodynamics often used, but that doesn't mean it's correct, though. The assumption is the detector does not significantly change the state of the field. Perturbation theory works. The coupling strength is small enough. Okay. Super important with that, now that you mentioned that. For very massive fields, that would also be true in the sense of like the gap to actually excite the field is high. So you have a gap. It takes, so this approximation of the field has a high heat capacity kind of thing would still be true. If it's zero mass, you can use this argument I told you of, yeah, you leave behind the propagations. You locally see the thermal state all the time. If it's intermediate mass regimes, then things get complicated. So yeah, these things are good. They're full of subtleties, these things. But it's super nice to be aware of them. I mean, like I'm not trying to sell you everything works really nice, but we try to tell you as far as we can do stuff, everything works the way we expected. And the remarkable thing is that we did not, and this is super important, we did not build the theory of particle detectors thinking we need to match this. This is a consequence. We build a theory of particle detectors as how do atoms couple to fields in real life kind of thing. So it's not a fine-tuned result. The chances that you're doing something right are high because you're getting what you should get from first principles out of using a model coming from somewhere else, right? That's what I think is quite beautiful about this. But of course, really good point, the detector here is not seeing, the field is not seeing the back reaction of the detector. Well, I mean, the field is seeing it, but we're tracing out the field. The detector is not seeing the effect of the back reaction on the field. You would need, at the same order, the detector feels the field, right? The field feels the detector. But for that perturbation of the field to affect back the detector, you need to go to order 4 instead of order 2, which is where we are right now. Order 3 is 0. And you can tell right away for a free theory anyways, because the Gaussian state of a free theory, because that would be the three-point function for order 3, and the odd-point functions are 0 in Gaussian states. Only the even-point functions, I mean, weak theorem, right? For a Gaussian state centered at 0, for a Gaussian state centered at 0 in phase space, a coherent state would not be true. So I did wrong statement, not for all Gaussian states. But for Gaussian states of expectation 0, which is a thermal state or the vacuum or a squeezed vacuum, for those states, the thermal field pair thing is also one of those. It's a squeezed state, a vacuum, squeezed vacuum. All the endpoint functions with n being odd are 0, which is very easy to prove. From weak theorem, you write it in terms of the one-point function that is 0, because you say the expectation of the field is 0. So the next order is fourth order. More questions? All right, that was nice. So tomorrow, which is Thursday, we'll do the Andrew effect. And you see, all that is left, because all the work that we did today, all that is left is to prove that the vacuum state of a free field is KMS with respect to partial tau associated to a constantly accelerated observer, because then everything follows here. If it's KMS, we get this result. We get detailed balance, right? So we need to prove that the vacuum is KMS with temperature A over 2 pi with respect to the generator of boosts, which is the proper time of partial tau of a constantly accelerated observer. And that will be tomorrow. Thank you, guys. Good question.